History isn't just a bunch of names and dates and facts. It's the collection of all the stories throughout human history that explain how and why we got here. Welcome to the History Unplugged podcast, where we look at the forgotten, neglected, strange, and even counterfactual stories that made our world what it is. I'm your host, Scott Rank. By mid-February 1945, the Wehrmacht, Germany's army, finally reached strategic bankruptcy. In January and February alone, it lost 660,000 men. The home army lacked the weapons, including small arms and ammunition, to equip new divisions. In January, against a monthly demand for 1.5 million tank and anti-tank rounds, production fell to 367,000. Despite this hopeless position, with Russia within 70 miles of Berlin, Hitler planned another offensive in Hungary using the 6th SS Panzer Division, and Hitler wanted to recapture Budapest and overrun eastern Hungary. And at this point, Hitler was in terminal decline. He was hopelessly addicted to amphetamines and cocaine, out of his mind, wanting to attack armies that didn't exist. So in this period in 1945, when many German soldiers and officers thought they were dead men walking, how were Hitler's forces finally defeated? What happened after the well-known Battle of the Bulge in 1944 and 1945? That clash wasn't the end for Nazi Germany, but the battles that followed and forced it into submission really haven't been covered as much as other parts of the war. Today, I'm joined with guest Sandy Mitchum, who's been on the show many times, to discuss his new book, The Death of Hitler's War Machine, The Final Destruction of the Wehrmacht. He uses a number of rarely seen German wartime papers and even talks about looking at Hitler's last will and statement and actually getting a sensation of what his bunker was like in the final days of the war. And in this period, the Wehrmacht was left fighting for its very survival, especially on the Eastern Front, where the Soviet Army was intent on matching or even surpassing Nazi atrocities. So in this episode, we're going to look at Hitler's disastrous foreign policy that pitted the Wehrmacht against most of the world, how Hitler refused to acknowledge reality and forbade German retreats, essentially condemning troops to death, why the Wehrmacht was slowly annihilated in horrific battles. The most brutal was the Soviet siege of Budapest, which became known as the Stalingrad of the Waffen-SS. And the loss of the air war, which led to the devastation of German cities and complete disruption of industry and infrastructure. And there's a lot of interesting points that come out here. One is that why it's important to behave humanely in wartime, where on the Western Front, tens and even hundreds of thousands of German troops willfully surrendered to the Allies because they knew that they'd be treated well. Whereas on the Eastern Front, they battled to the death, knowing that they'd be at best sent to labor camps in the Soviet Union, at worst brutally murdered. So many more Soviet soldiers died than perhaps they needed to. So there's a lot to unpack here in this very important period at the end of World War II. And I hope you enjoyed this discussion with Sandy Mitchum. All right, Sandy, welcome back to the show. This is the fifth time?
Yeah, it is.
Okay. Well, we've done just about everything. I mean, we've looked at World War II. We've looked at the Civil War. And this is, I don't know if I could call it a capstone of the research you've done over your career, but you've written over 40 books, perhaps the most of any guest I've had, and many of your books are about World War II. So what made you decide to write about the end of the Wehrmacht and what you call the death of Hitler's war machine?
Well, many years ago, I was reaching something at the U.S. National Archives, and they sent me to a Bay Area where the general public wasn't allowed, and I met a guy named Georg Wegener, who was looking for Lewis' filing cabinet. And I asked him, can't you find it? And he said, no, he couldn't. And he was looking for a copy of Hitler's last will and testament. And we became friends. He said he wasn't looking at the original. It was in the vault. Nobody got to see that. But he had read some of my books, and other people came in. We had a big bull session going. And he disappeared a while and came back, and he had gone to the vault and checked out the actual copy of Hitler's last will and testament. And there were five signatories. They were all dead within 72 hours. But he told me, he handed it to me and told me to close my eyes, put the nose to the paper, and smell it. And I did. And the odor of the Führer bunker had permeated that paper. You could smell the dust and the dankness, and the powder. And for just a second, I had the sensation of being in the Fehrerbach. And I lifted my nose from the paper and looked at him and said, "Wow." And he said, "Exactly." And I decided I was going to eventually write a book about the end of the Third Reich. And this is it. That was sort of the genesis of it.
Can you describe that when you smelled it and you were transported briefly back in time? What entered your mind's eye? What sensation did you have?
Well, it was surreal. You kind of feel the desperation, the hopelessness, some of the evil. It was a strange sensation. And that's as close as I ever want to get to an actual Fehrerbacher.
Right. I mean, nothing good about it. It's for listeners, if they've seen the movie Downfall, it's just desperation after hopelessness, and it's compounding. Well, before we dig in too far into this, for listeners who maybe don't know the overview, can you give us an overview of what happened from December 1944, the Battle of the Bulge, to German surrender in May 1945?
Well, I think the last chance the Third Reich had to win the war was the Normandy invasion. Had they repulsed that, they had a chance maybe not to win, but at least to survive. After the Allies successfully landed in Normandy, the chances went down to not quite zero. The Battle of the Bulge was the last real chance they had to inflict a stinging defeat on the Western Allies. And of course, that didn't happen. By January 1945, anybody who was realistic realized that the Third Reich was not going to survive. A great many people pretended they thought it was going to survive. Matter of fact, there was a joke in Germany at the time. It's easier to believe in final victory than it is to run around Berlin without your head. The Nazis were executing people for defeatism. It was a very lethal time, brutal. The bombings were terrible. The Germans lost 500,000 to 600,000 people in the bombings alone. Great Britain lost about 50,000. So there were about 10 times as many Germans killed in the bombing of the cities as even in the Battle of Britain. I think that was a major motivation for a lot of people just to survive. There were treks. I talk about them trying to get out of the way of the Russian army and the Russian air force. Just treks of civilians trying to get to ports or back to Western Germany. It was winter. It was a cold winter. A lot of ice and snow. I knew a young girl that she was then. She's a kid, and kids had particular problems. You and I are adults. If we have to, we can make our shoes last another year by repairing them. Not the case with children who outgrow their shoes. She was barefooted in East Prussia, January 1945. So her mother did what a lot of them did. She made what I call cow patty shoes. She would dip her daughter's feet in cow manure and let it solidify, dip it again, solidify, until the girl had that's all she had for shoes was cow manure. But she walked all the way across East Prussia, the Danzig Corridor, across Pomerania, and halfway across Brandenburg with these things, and never suffered the slightest health repercussions from it. They were very ingenious, the people who were trying to survive. But, of course, a lot of them didn't.
Yeah, I'm curious for... There are civilians that are suffering. They become refugees. For soldiers and officers, what was their mood like when it became clear after January that this was hopeless? Do they have gallows humor? Do they consider themselves dead men walking? What's their perception of the situation they're in? Or were they so deeply imbibed in the ideology of Nazism that they were blinded to reality? What was your take on it?
That's a really good question. A lot of it depended on where you were. If you were on the Western Front, you could reasonably assume that you would be taken prisoner and treated decently. And there were exceptions to that, but generally that's what happened. On the East, it was quite different. you had fanatical resistance because they didn't want the Russians to enter Germany, because a lot of rape, a lot of murder, some horrible things occurred, gang rape in Berlin, which was down to about 3 million people at that time. They estimate one out of every 3 or 4 women was raped. And they had 103,000 cases of venereal disease after the Battle of Berlin that were reported. And there was a certain loyalty of the unit, which you don't see much in America, because we draft people and put people from all different states in the same unit. The Germans didn't do it that way. They, if you were from Pomerania, they would put you in a certain unit with other Pomeranians, East Prussia. And those men who were defending their homes against the Russians held up surprisingly well until early April 1945, when, as General Henrici said, the soldiers spoke and they decided the war was lost and they started going home en masse.
Right. There's huge defections. And then this is the tug of war between the high command and soldiers on the ground. Jumping back up to high-level planning and military strategy and tactics, first of all, let's look at things from Hitler's perspective, because he does have that delusional fanaticism to the very end, of course. What were some of the biggest tactical mistakes that he made after the Battle of the Bulge? And along with that, really, could he have done anything, or was the war completely lost and simply fighting was a tactical mistake?
I think simply fighting after the Battle of the Bulge was a mistake. Yeah, there was nothing more he could do. Of course, you try to tell him that, you'd risk your life. He was delusional. He even ordered the attack of an army that did not exist. Hitler was a walking basket case by then, partially because of his medical situation. I acquired a copy of his doctor's diaries and befriended a man who whose daughter owned a medical corporation, and he asked her to get some of the doctors who worked for her to identify some of these drugs. Many of them had not been manufactured since the 1950s. And it turns out that Hitler had a vitamin toxicity. He was addicted to amphetamines or speed, and the active ingredient in his eye drops was cocaine. And he took up to 19 applications per day. So I don't think it would have lasted more than a year or two had he not been forced to commit suicide. Hitler was, and you can see that in the terrible mood swings that he had. One day it'd be despair. The next day he'd see how he could win the war. And so he was... he was on a delicate mental perch much of his life. I think his experience in World War I had a lot to do with that. But somewhere around 1942, he fell off that perch and was basically insane. And by 1945, he was pronouncedly insane. But he was still fearful, so his orders were obeyed to the end.
Yeah, exactly. You're given a command that's delusional, but you're executed if you don't follow through. And this is carried out by an officer corps that is competent, famously competent. With that in mind, could you describe the offensive into Hungary in 1945? Why did Germany do this? Why was it so important to secure Hungary at this point in the war? And what happened there?
Well, Hungary was a German ally, and some of them, a great many of them, were actively supporting the Nazis and their own version of the Nazi Party. And they had to keep those oil fields in Hungary. That didn't amount to much, but it was the last petroleum Germany had. And, you know, without oil and gas, you can't run a war in the 20th century, 21st century either. So he wanted to defend that. He wanted to save Budapest, where some of his SS divisions were surrounded. But in doing this, he basically uncovered Berlin. When the major offensive against Berlin came, the Russians were able to commit 2.2 million troops, and the Germans only had 400,000. And the Russians had 10,000 airplanes, the Germans had 300. And they were outnumbered similarly in tanks and assault guns. it was the Reich could probably last another month or two had those forces been used to defend Germany. But I'm not, of course, that's speculation, but I think they could have lasted a little longer. But in the end would have been the same.
So that's why it was called the Stalingrad of the SS, the Soviet siege of Budapest?
Yes, very few of those men got out. I think there were 33,000 defenders to start with. 800 of them eventually made it back to German lines. The rest were captured or killed, mostly killed. There wasn't much left of Budapest when the Russians finally did take it. And there wasn't much left to defend Austria with. Budapest lasted weeks. Vienna didn't last 7 days.
Something I'm interested in is you've talked about some of the sources that you use for this book. There's Hitler's Last Will and Testament and some other rarely seen German wartime documents. How did you learn about, let's say, perspectives from officers or others who thought that the war effort was hopeless when, like you said, you have to be very careful with how you phrase things because you don't want to be executed. But of course, in 1945, I mean, when it's becoming obvious to those who can look rationally that the war effort's lost, what sort of sources you think gave you honest accounts of what people were really thinking at this time?
Well, I've done personal interviews, huge number of sources. It's difficult to narrow it down into one, but the Germans will tell you the truth. And one thing about it, the Americans came home and, you know, like my daddy didn't want to talk about the war. My uncle didn't want to talk about it much. It was different for the German veteran because the way the modern generation, now grandparents, dealt with the Holocaust and the war guilt was to tune it out. So that was my father's war. It has nothing to do with me. And they didn't want to talk about it. In fact, the way a kid would deal with his father's talking about the war is politely excuse himself and leave the room. And this made it a lot easier to interview German soldiers for people like me because the guy wanted to talk about it. He had nobody else to talk about it with. And here's a young person, which I was then, who wants to hear his war stories. So he would tell you what happened and sometimes tell you something you didn't want to know. But that was my experience. The Germans, the older generation, which is now fading away like ours, was much more willing to talk about it. Well, I remember one man, he was an SS man who refused to talk to me about it. He was polite, but he was also involved in some killing of Canadian prisoners, and he was, shall we say, lying low. But other than that, getting information wasn't so hard from the Germans. You know, one aspect of the book I talk about that most people don't is the sinking of the ships. They were evacuating East Prussia because of the Russians. And the German Navy evacuated over 2 million civilians from Pomerania and East Prussia. And the total population of East Prussia at that time was 3 million. So they took huge amounts of people. But the Russians were trying to sink the passenger liners. And one of them was the Wilhelm Gustloff. Tell the story of some of the survivors of that. It was a ship rated for about 1,800 people, including crew. And they had 10,582 people on board. And it was sunk by a Russian submarine. And only about 1,200 people survived. So more than 8,000, closer to 9,000 people were killed by the torpedoes or drowned. And the Titanic only lost 1,500. There were more people killed on the Wilhelm Gustloff and the Titanic, Lusitania, the Andrea Dora, the Empress of Ireland combined. And that affected the people not at all. They still wanted to take their chances and get away from the Russians. In fact, there are several cases where they were waiting in line to get on a boat, and they were attacked by the Russian Air Force. And these people didn't take cover because they would lose their place in line if they did. So they were desperate to get out of there.
Hey everyone, Scott here. We're going to take a very short break for a word from our sponsors.
Something else, too, in your book you talk about are desertions when entire units realize that the war is futile. That's what they do. There's one story that's very interesting when Hitler is giving nonsensical orders, ordering armies to attack. One particular case is a commander of the 1st, 2nd, 3rd, and 9th Panzer Divisions, Dietrich, who refuses an order of Hitler. Can you tell that story?
Well, it was in Hungary, and they got another irrational order from Führer headquarters. Didn't want to obey it, and Hitler stripped them of their honor. They had to take off their Hitler armbands and cuff bands. And Sepp Dietrich was the commander of the what they call the 6th SS Panzer Army. Dietrich said they call us SS Panzer Army 6 because we only got 6 tanks left. And they weren't able to carry out a counterattack the way Hitler wanted them to. And when he stripped them of their honor, Dietrich had the men put their cuff bands and decorations in a chamber pot. And the Ghost was the name of the commander of the 17th SS Panzer Grenadier Division, which was involved in this. They put that armband on the handle of the chamber pot. And it comes from a play written by Goethe, in which the bishop tells the prince, lick my ass. And that was what the division was named after. That's basically what Dietrich was telling Hitler. Hitler would have understood the nuance there. And Dietrich had it sent to Führer headquarters. Although I'm not able to determine that Hitler ever saw it, I suspect he didn't. Somebody kept that from him because he really would have come unglued at that point. Trick was surrounded his headquarters with loyal troops. He fought Hitler but tried to have him arrested. But the end came too quickly. He never did. Hmm. Dietrich had been Hitler's chauffeur and bodyguard before the war, so it was definitely a falling out of what had formerly been a loyal Nazi.
Are there any other stories like this that really stick out to you from this period?
There are quite a few. There was one case, I don't think it was in this book, but they were firebombing the German cities. And the firemen, there was a bunker with about 1,000 German civilians and an air raid shelter, and it was totally surrounded by fire, and they knew that they would die if they weren't rescued. So they got the fire hoses and kind of broke through the flames. And, of course, one falling building had fallen on that fire hose just 1 minute. All the firemen would have been engulfed in flames and killed. So they took a heck of a chance. They got everybody out. I talk about Dresden in this book. There were about twice as many Germans killed in the firebombing of Dresden as were killed in the whole Battle of Britain. And you could see the fireball 200 miles away. So Germany was totally devastated. 85 to 90% of all buildings were destroyed. In fact, the Germans had a joke about it. The Allies continue bombing at this rate, they're going to have to start bringing their own targets. There's just nothing in Germany worth destroying anymore. That was pretty accurate. They were, especially in the East, if they just got away with their lives, they considered themselves lucky.
Right. All these things happening, you mentioned a ship that sunk and far more died than the Titanic, or the firebombing of Dresden, far more people died than the Battle of Britain. But we don't hear about these cases. Do you think it's because there's so much devastation and so much destruction happening in this 6-month period that it just seems like it's, you know, white noise? It's just constant destruction, constant devastation, and hard to pick anything out from another? Or do you think it's something else?
There's a number of factors there. It's a very complex situation. I think at some point your brain shorts out and it's hard to grasp. Like Stalin said, one man's death is a tragedy. A million men's death is a statistic. It's hard to grasp that. Also, there's an issue of German guilt. I mean, they did some horrible things in Russia, the Holocaust, mass murder of Jews. A lot of Americans at that time thought that the Germans deserved it. And, the passions of war, a lot of people felt that way in 1945. Who would have felt differently today, because time has put some distance between us and them. And then again, we don't know that much history. A lot of people don't. They focus on the West, which is natural. But things were much different on the Eastern Front than the West. The kids would greet the American soldiers, and the women wanted nylons, and the kids wanted candy. And the American would produce the candy. And some of them produced the nylons. They wouldn't do that with the Russian, because they were pretty savage on the Germans. A lot of them from especially Asiatic Russia were not well educated. I read about a young Russian soldier. He was a good soldier. He's in headquarters for some reason or other. And a cuckoo clock sounded the hour, and he freaked and screamed, "It's the devil!" And he machine gunned the cuckoo clock. And of course, headquarters was completely disrupted. And the commissar tried to convince the boy that it really wasn't Satan, but he was convinced it was. And there was another woman. The Russian was about to rape her, apparently, and she went into the bedroom. He kicked open the door and stormed in, and she fell backward. And the commode bowl was above the commode in those days. And she pulled the cord, and it caused the commode to flush. And he was astonished, and the Russian forgot all about the German woman, and he ran off. And she lay there on the floor a few moments. She was relieved, sort of in shock, and came out of the commode, and suddenly here's that Russian back again. He's got 10 of his buddies. And she thought she was going to be gang raped. She thought it was all over. He pushed her aside and took his buddies into the commode and showed them how to flush the commode. And she escaped. They weren't interested in her anymore. So it was a primitive time for some of those people. And they took out the war on the Germans. But all sorts of things were happening in Berlin at that time, good and bad, mostly bad.
Once the war finally ends in May, this is after Hitler's suicide, what happens? I mean, people, it seems like for months, are in the stupor where it's constant violence, constant destruction. Do some people sort of, I don't know, does anything change? Are they still in a state of shock? Is it like they're waking up from a nightmare? What's your sense of May 1945 in Berlin?
Relief. Now, Berlin was basically occupied by the Russians, and a lot of them wanted to get away, and a lot of them did because the Berlin Wall had not been built. Overall in Germany, it was relief. They were glad it was over, and then they started over again. The thing about the Germans, say a lot of negative about them, but they are extremely clean people. When the war was over, they started rebuilding. They started cleaning up the streets. They were relieved in general. Of course, a lot of the men were in prison. Now, in the east, a lot of villages were taken over by the Russians, and people were made to be slave laborers. And that didn't happen much in the west. We kept our prisoners until 1947 as a general rule. They did that to use them as laborers to help rebuild Britain, France, what have you. But they were a lot better treated by the Americans than the Russians.
So one last thing to tie this together. You spoke directly to German veterans of the war. And Only a few years before the end, they're riding high. They believe their army is invincible, and it appears that way to the Allies. They're just running roughshod over Europe, it seems like, for many. They're avenging the humiliation of World War I. Hitler made this extremely explicit with using the imagery of the Treaty of Versailles and everything. So in the early 1940s, there's a feeling of invincibility. And then in a very short amount of time, in less than a year from D-Day, then especially after the Battle of the Bulge, within a few months, it all comes crashing down. And they were once an invincible army. Now they're completely bombed. They're cratered. They're being led by a madman who died shamefully by suicide. And they're the scorn of the world. So when you talked with veterans, what did they make of that incredibly rapid shift?
Hey, everyone. Scott here. One more brief word from our sponsors.
Well, to them, it wasn't rapid. 1 year on the Eastern Front would seem like 10 years to you and I. They didn't look at it as a rapid shift. They talked to a veteran of the Battle of Sicily once, and he was mentioning that they were we were defeated and retreating from the enemy who was superior to us only in the material sense. They kept a little of that German arrogance, which, you know, can be good. You want your, like a fighter pilot told me, they wanted to feel like they were the better man than their opponents. And I don't think they lost that. They lost the material race. I mean, Germany had some panzer divisions, 30 of them, but they had a lot more infantry divisions. Most of their artillery was horse-drawn. They had superior mobility to the Poles, but even France had more tanks, and some of them were better tanks than the German tanks. The Germans excelled was communications and tactics. French tanks and the Russian tanks, too, didn't have reliable radios. And early in the war, the Russian tanks didn't have radios at all. So the commander would have to stick his head out of the turret, start waving flags, which is something you don't want to do in the middle of a battle. But the superiority of the Panzer tank was largely a myth. General von Militain talked about that in his book, Panzer Battles. The Germans were a warlike people, and they communicated better and therefore had better tactics. But the material superiority didn't really exist in 1942, and it certainly didn't by 1945. The Russians had fleets of American-manufactured vehicles. In fact, even 5 years after the war, the word Studebaker was synonymous with truck in the Soviet Union. But so up until the Germans decided to go home in April of 45, they would still put up a pretty good fight on the Eastern Front.
Right. And this is something that I think gets lost in World War II after the Battle of the Bulge. It just becomes a march to Victory Day and then to Berlin. But it's a good point that understanding how it came crashing down is showing the failure of Hitler's war machine, and also seeing how the principles that fueled Nazi Germany and the Wehrmacht and everything else, how they came crumbling down when they came up against reality, especially when it's led by someone who is not connected with reality. Well, there's a lot more to go into in your book. And for listeners who want to check it out, where can people go to buy The Death of Hitler's War Machine?
Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Regnery History, all those things. One thing I want to make is it entirely different in the East and the West. Big battle on the Western Front after D-Day was the Battle of the Ruhr Pocket. 300,000 Germans surrendered. Our total casualties were 17,000. One of the most lopsided victories in history, but it's because they realized that they were going to lose, and they didn't want to be the last one killed, and that they would probably be treated decently. Some of them weren't, but by and large, most of them came home. It was entirely different in the East. And I think that one of the lessons learned is terrorism can be counterproductive. It certainly was for the Soviets. Another thing I see differently from other authors as the Hitler Youth. It's almost cliche to lament these boys being sacrificed, and it was bad. But they weren't as useless as or as hopeless as a lot of authors represent them. In Berlin, for example, the boys from Hitler Youth, you know, boys are fond of exploring, and they knew the sewage system. And what they would do is they get these Panzerfausten, the single-shot disposable anti-tank weapons. They would know where the Russians were, and they would come in behind them using the sewage systems and fire at the rear of the tank where the armistice finished and blow it up, disappear down a manhole cover, and repeat the performance again later. The Russians lost 700 tanks in Berlin. That's enough to equip an entire tank army plus. And most of that was done by Hitler Youth types. So I guess I have a higher view of their military value in street fighting than most Americans.
Right. Especially after years of an insurgency, you can see that untrained people can really wreak damage. And that's a great point you mentioned, too, about the Eastern Front, that as much as the Red Army was seeking revenge, they really brought a lot more death upon themselves, that had they behaved humanely, they could have just seen hundreds of thousands of soldiers surrender and then peacefully come from the east. But it did not go that way. So very good point there. Well, really appreciate you sharing all this. And thank you for joining us. And I look forward to having you on next time for your next book.
All right. Thank you, Scott. It's always a pleasure.
All right. That is all for today's episode. As a first order of business, I need to thank the Knowlton's Rangers, and I'll explain what that is in a second. And they are Kristen Lee, Willie from New Jersey, Suma 41, Sergeant Hooch, Wire Meets Wood Guitars at WMWGuitars.com, Bill Ivey, Tom from Ohio, Salvador Sanchez, Dane Carlson from Linwood, Washington, Rob from Chicago, Nick Brooks, Michael Piccinetti, Michael from New York, Jeff Mitchell, owner of Mountain West Commercial Las Vegas, Josh Reddick, Jake Harrington, Josh from BFW Post 2285, David Santee, Chris C., and Baron Fraser. Now, if you'd like to support History Unplugged and help it grow, there are three easy ways to do so. First, subscribe to the show and leave a review on the podcast player of your choice. This helps other people discover the show. Second, join our Facebook group, and here you can discuss recent episodes with fellow listeners, mention what you'd like to see on the show in the future, and get way more out of the show, and just look for History Unplugged on Facebook. Third, become a member of the Knowlton's Rangers. The Knowlton's Rangers were an elite reconnaissance and espionage detachment of the Continental Army established by George Washington, but it's also the membership group of History Unplugged, and here you can really dive in way deeper with the show. You can check it out by going to Patreon, patreon.com/unplugged. If you join at the Scout level, you get early access to new podcast episodes, and you get completely ad-free versions of the entire back catalog of more than 500 episodes. Plus, everything is neatly categorized, so if you want to listen to something about the Middle Ages and skip all the Civil War stuff or vice versa, you can easily find an old episode from 3 years ago that, if you're just looking on Apple Podcasts, would be buried in the feed. If you join at the Intelligence Officer level, you get all the same stuff, but access to a growing catalog of now more than 60 premium episodes that come out bi-weekly, including a multi-part series on the life of Audie Murphy, the most decorated combat soldier in World War II, a series on French Foreign Legion fighters in World War I, one on Teddy Roosevelt's years in the Dakota Badlands, and a series on Nazi attempts to assassinate FDR, Churchill, and Stalin in 1943. Lastly, if you join the Spymaster level, you get all the same stuff as level 1 and 2, but you also get a shout-out to you and or your business at the end of each episode. You can choose a historical topic on absolutely anything, and I'll base an hour-long episode on it. Plus, you get a 3-pack of hardcover books. So again, check it all out by going to patreon.com/unplugged. Well, that's all for today's episode. Thank you so much for listening, and see you next time.